This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, wish you a joyous and loving Pride Month. And to celebrate, today I'm playing two of The Allusionist episodes that have stuck with me the most during the show's existence. The first one is called Joins. It came about a couple of years ago, thanks to you listeners, who talked about your particular experiences in your trans bodies, dealing with the available vocabulary for sex and the associated body parts. Content note, the episode contains language pertaining to sex and the associated body parts. After this, there'll be a short piece about a monumental moment in time, but right now, here is Joins.
Hello, my name is Lee. I'm a genderqueer, trans, masculine, gay guy, and it's time for me to talk to Helen Zaltzman about my genitals. So there's actually a lot of different contexts in which genitals come up, and there's different language for each of them. For me, as someone who was assigned female at birth, has a vagina, has a uterus, but mostly passes as male, there's a lot of different things that go into what I'm choosing to call my genitals.
I sometimes refer to my genitalia as anachronistic, which seems to fit perfectly. I have a friend who refers to my genitalia as the factory installed equipment.
My name is Matty, and I am both transgender and asexual. And both these things influence how I relate to my body and the words that I use for it. Asexuality means different things to different people. For me, it means a sexual orientation that refers to little to no sexual attraction to people of any gender. Transgender means that my gender and the body that I was born with don't quite align, and gender dysphoria is the discomfort I feel because of that disconnect.
So I want to start off by saying that I am not an example for every single trans person. Every trans person's different. Some of them are perfectly fine when it comes to labeling their junk with the clinical terms. Others, like me, have a problem connecting with that area, so they use labels that they make up in order to help disassociate themselves from that area in order to alleviate dysphoria.
I find that the words used for my own genitals impacts how dysphoric I feel, so I'm more uncomfortable with words that are more vulgar or euphemistic, like cock or balls, but I'm better with, I suppose, more medical words, like penis. Maybe because those words feel a little more impersonal, since I can't personally relate to any of the words associated with my genitals.
I'm a non-binary person, and I didn't have the vocab to explain that. And I knew I wasn't a man, and I knew I wasn't a woman, but I just thought I was crap at being a woman. But no, I was just non-binary. I was genderqueer. So yeah, my boobs are non-binary boobs. Deal with it.
The general vaginal area is simply the front hole. Vagina is front hole. Asshole is back hole. The clit is the dick or the bio dick. And the packers or STPs, if you don't know what a packer or STP is, just think of it as a flaccid dildo. You know, it's just something to stick in your pants and give the illusion of a bulge. I call those my peens, P-E-E-N.
In a lot of contexts, I actually do end up defaulting to vagina. Some of that is my, you know, good feminism saying, you know, we call the things what they are, although many people I know object to me using vagina instead of vulva, but I can't get behind vulva.
This is Rebecca Kling. I am a performance artist, an educator, a writer, and a transgender woman. Speaking for myself, I didn't have a problem calling my genitalia a penis or a cock or a dick before I had surgery. That said, I've heard people call it a clit or a super clit. I've heard people call it a click, a combination of clit and dick. I've heard people use other language like hammer, which I thought was pretty great, or fun stick. I've heard garden or flower, button or hotspot. And if everything else fails, you can either pick names. So what name is going to make you feel good about your genitalia? Or at the sort of most directly descriptive, this, that, here, there. Grab your partner's hand. I want you to touch me here. I don't like it when you touch me there. And I think part of the excitement there is being able to decide what language is going to make you feel good about yourself. Similarly, now that I have had gender reassignment surgery, so I do have a vagina, I like words like vagina or pussy or cunt because they feel right and they feel okay to me.
My name is Owl. I'm an Icelandic trans person who now lives in the UK. I identify as a non-binary trans person and I use the pronoun they. Before I came out, I didn't really, you know, want to speak about my genitals or my body at all in many ways because I felt I wasn't comfortable with my body in many ways. But I feel like after I started hormones or after I, you know, had genital surgery, I became much more comfortable with my own body because I was basically hiding it away all the time anyway. But I feel like now I sort of don't have to hide it away. But I feel like it's not necessarily because I became this super confident person. I also feel like it's because my body was just completely objectified as I went through the medical process. And I remember being in the hospital after my genital surgery, and every time the doctor came every morning, he brought about two or three different sort of students who were studying medicine or becoming doctors, and he asked if it was okay if they took a look as well. So about 30 or 40 people at that hospital saw my pussy. You know, I just became a bit detached from it. And today, I'm not very shy at all. I don't care as much. I can speak about my pussy, my vagina, and I'm not shy to say these words because I sort of feel like my body now conforms to how I want to be, you know. And the ways it's changed is that I talk about my genitals now, as before I never actually talked about them at all.
You would not believe how much you end up talking about genitals with little kids. It's an interesting thing being a genderqueer parent and talking about how some boys have vaginas, most boys have penises, most girls have vaginas, but some girls have penises, things like that. Trying to divorce anatomy from identity for the next generation.
Language around trans bodies is difficult for a couple of reasons. First, it's because a lot of the time, people who are asking trans folks about their bodies have this assumption that they're allowed to ask whatever they want. What's between your legs? Have you had the surgery? How's dating like? How do you have sex? All of these questions that we would never ask someone that we just met or that we just learned something about their identity. On the other hand, there's need-to-know situations. My doctor probably needs to know a lot about my medical history and my body, but the barista at a coffee shop doesn't need to know.
When it comes to going to the doctors, I do refer to those areas as their clinical names. If I used my nicknames, that would just confuse the doctors. But the difference is that I use the instead of my. So an example is I just use the clit instead of my clit. And that's to just help disassociate myself.
When it comes to sexy times, there's not a lot of good language right now.
I guess I generally try to go for neutral words. I'm like whole, I'm like front hole, back hole.
There's a lot of fun creative language used in some erotica or in just talking about things, especially for guys who are really uncomfortable talking about themselves as having vaginas. Front hole, cockpit. A guy messaged me on Scruff the other day and asked me if I was a bonus hole boy, which was his way of trying to sexily ask me if I participated in vaginal intercourse. And that was funny. I hadn't heard that one in a while.
If you're dating a trans person and you plan on having sex with them, it's best to, you know, just talk to them and see what labels they prefer to use. And I've been in relationships where it's like right in the middle of things. They refer to as my front hole as my pussy or my vagina. And that did not go well. I had a full-on dysphoria attack right in the bed, and that was not good. So it is best to sit down with your partner and talk with them. Communication is key.
There's this misconception that asking has to be really awkward and dry. Excuse me, what language are you using for the genitalia that's between your legs? And what language would I appropriately use to discuss that genitalia? No. What language feels sexy? What language feels good? Can I touch you here? What word do you use? What do you call this? There are ways to make talking about sex and talking about the language of sex and bodies fun and part of the experience, and not have to pull out a whiteboard and dry erase markers to start diagramming things out.
I mean, I make them fill out a form. No, just kidding. My name is Andre Perez. I'm a community organizer, filmmaker, mixed race, Puerto Rican, trans masculine person who's kind of genderqueer and also very queer. I love the word cock. My phone, incidentally, does not like the word cock. It always autocorrects it to couch. My phone just thinks that I have a lot of really intense conversations about purchasing couches on the weekend. I'm like, let me see your couch. How big is it? Like, is it hard? Does it feel good?
There's a fair amount of just referring to things as it. Suck it, fuck it, lick it. That sort of non-specificness that works for any sort of part that someone is near, whether it's genitals or not.
I'm pretty good at like redirecting people, like, oh, I don't really like that word. I'd really prefer if you use this word. I often will find that men will not be very familiar with trans folks, and so they will be kind of tentative. And actually, I'd say that's maybe something that I look for that's like appealing, is I'm like, oh, if you don't know everything to do, that's fine.
It's an evolving language thing, and it's made more complicated by how little language even cisgendered people with vaginas have for their vaginas that aren't like puerile or offensive or combative or medical. So, yeah, we all need to do better.
My name is Lorelei Arises. I'm a newspaper columnist for the Rainbow Times. I write the column Ask a Trans Woman, and I'm the original Miss Trans New England. Language is a living thing, you know? It's not static. It responds, it shapes our world, and it allows us to shape our worlds in turn. So, you know, the words I use to refer to my genitalia are really very genuinely going to shape the reality of that genitalia to a certain extent. It's really exciting. It's a very cutting edge sort of word nursery in the trans community. The words we use for ourselves are changing constantly, and that's changing our ideas about what gender even is, and our ideas about what gender is consequently changing the language and the words we use to describe gender. And given that so many people's genitalia is so tied into our ideas about gender generally and specifically personally, that means that the words we're using to describe our genitalia are in a constant state of flux.
One of the most important lessons from the trans rights movement that I want to spread to the world is that we get to decide what our bodies mean, and we get to decide how our bodies should be used and interact with the world. And what I mean by that is, if certain language doesn't feel right about your body, don't use that language. And for trans folks in particular, there are parts of our bodies, whether it's breasts or vaginas or penises or whatever, that those words carry a lot of weight the weight of being told you have a vagina or being told you have a penis, and that means something that's gendered, and that means something that's sexualized about what you're supposed to do with that part. Because words are all tied up in how we think about our bodies, and how we think about our bodies is all tied up in the language we use to describe our bodies.
Thanks so much to everyone who contributed to this piece. In alphabetical order, Andre, Lee, Lorelei, Marshall, Matty, Owl, Rebecca, and Cez. And thanks to Sarah Geis for her work on this episode. Coming up next, Pride. It's 49 years since the word Pride was chosen for LGBTQ Pride events. And when I made this episode in 2015, I hadn't before encountered the story of why that particular word was chosen. And it is a powerful story. The audio quality is a little crackly, but there is a transcript at theillusionist.org/transcripts. Here it is. Pride. New York City in 1970. Homosexuality was still classified as a mental illness. Gay sex was punishable with fines and prison sentences. A police raid on the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street on the 28th of June 1969 sparked the Stonewall riots, after which, for the gay civil rights movement, Pride began to mean something more.
My name is Craig Schoonmaker, and in 1970 offered the term gay pride as it has been used since then. I mean, somebody had to come up with it. The way it happened is that we had a committee, the Christopher Street Liberation Day Committee, that was forming the first annual gay march to celebrate the Stonewall riots the prior year. And I was on the committee. We were going to create a number of events the same weekend as the march to bring people in from out of town, and wanted to unify the weekend of events under a single label. And the first thought was apparently Gay Power Weekend. I did not like that. I proposed Gay Pride because there's very little chance in most of the world for people to have power. Gay people did not have power then, and we only now have some. So anybody could have pride in themselves, and that would make them more happier as people and produce a movement that would likely produce change.
But the word pride carries negative connotations too, of conceit or vanity. Pride is one of the seven deadly sins.
Oh no, this is not that kind of pridefulness. It's more like self-esteem, but that was sort of hackneyed even then. The poison was shame, and the antidote to that is pride. And I understood that, and the committee understood apparently also, because there was no discussion, they immediately voted to make it Gay Pride Weekend.
There were events with names like Gay Liberation and Gay Freedom, or named after Christopher Street, but over the years most of them have adopted the name Pride.
It's always better to have a standard rubric that everybody recognizes. Pride is just shorthand for gay pride, and it didn't start out that way. Just remember that a lot of people were very repressed. They were conflicted internally and didn't really know to come out and be proud. So that's how the word gay pride proved most useful. Because it made people think, maybe I should be proud.
What kind of environment was it then for gay people to be living in?
Plainly, the Stonewall riots resulted from police invasion of a gay bar and a form of oppression. I was, for instance, arrested in August of 1968 while talking to a friend on Christopher Street, and refusing to break it up and move on, which was a standard language, because we were not loud, and it was abusive. So I spent the night in jail and went to Mattachine Society, which was the only organization for gay people at that time, and they mentioned it in the newsletter. But around that same time, Mayor Lindsay made a basic change in police instructions and had them stop harassing gay people. So it was a fortunate confluence of events. Mayor Lindsay had already made changes in police policy. So the police were either not noticeable or were actually standing by to protect marchers if any trouble developed. And that was a nice change. But the laws didn't change for a long time. And we were constantly pushing. They would do things like invade the offices of a hostile magazine just to make sure they knew that we were watching and we're not going to put up with slander. So that was good. And they would also demonstrate outside the offices of hostile legislators, things like that. But it took a while, even with this kind of confrontation, to get things done. Meanwhile, there were publishing organizations like mine, Homosexuals and Transgender, and we continued to work on the intellectual underpinnings of the movement. And we tried to bring people to terms with their sexuality. We were always influenced in the United States by the Black Civil Rights Movement, which preceded us, but not by that much. Black Civil Rights Movement, as I say, was a pathfinder. It showed us how to proceed in a nonviolent fashion. And when we organized the march, first march, we had Quakers as trainers on what to do and what to avoid doing when we held our march. We were not supposed to wander out of the, I think it was then one or two lanes of the Avenue of the Americas, which is called 6th Avenue in the original street grid. And we were by no means to be aggressive toward the police, disrespectful in any way, and certainly not violent in any way. And it turned out to be a very orderly march. People did not violate any of the terms, and we were not interfered with by the police. It wasn't very large in terms of the numbers of people. It might have been as many as 3,000 to 5,000 in the street and people on the sidewalk. It had not yet caught on because it had never happened before. And we were chanting, I'm trying to remember what the words of the chants might have been. Things like gay is good, say it loud, I'm gay and I'm proud, things like that. It was quite festive. It was in the summertime because that's when the Stonewall riots occurred, and the weather was nice. It wasn't rainy or anything bad. So it was actually festive, and it went up to Central Park. And then we were joined by more people in the park, and somebody I overheard who was looking out over the group, which was probably at that point maybe 10,000, and said, just think, there's somebody out there for every one of us in that crowd, which was a nice thing. People were able to acknowledge themselves and be open in public, which is something you didn't see before. Most of it, of the gay life, was at night in bars and clubs. And in Greenwich Village, you would have people walking around on Sundays especially, but not generally outside the gay mecca of the West Village.
That same weekend, Los Angeles and San Francisco held their own marches, and within a couple of years, gay rights marches were happening in cities across the US. And in the 45 years since, Pride events have been taking place in hundreds of cities around the world.
Do you still think the word Pride is necessary for gay people?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. See, because it works, I don't want to say insidiously, it works internally. And it makes people more self-assertive. And that's what really is going to make the change in people's lives. When they assert the right to marry, when they assert the right to be known, when they assert their rights to employment under the various state and local laws and regulations, So there's a lot of work to be done in the world at large, but the more that people are open and self-assertive in the first world, the more easy it is for people in the third world to see that they have a possibility of change too.
Would you have anticipated that Pride would be not only still the term now, but it'd be all over the world and there'd be a whole month devoted to it?
No, I don't think so. I'm very happy it did, but we didn't anticipate that. Well, we hoped it would be in the United States for sure, because there were other marches. That year they also had one in Los Angeles and one in San Francisco. And we certainly hoped that it would catch on. Not as a slogan so much as an understanding that people should be proud and not ashamed.
How do you feel about Pride marches starting off political and now a lot of them have evolved into parties and parades?
I'm pretty happy about that because many of the goals have been achieved. And why not celebrate? Rarely, if ever, has any social movement come so far in so short a time.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is purfle, verb transitive, to ornament the edge of, e.g. with embroidery or inlay. Noun, purfling, a decorative border, especially around the edges of a violin. Try using it in an email today. These episodes were produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with music from Martin Austrick of palebirdmusic.com. The Illusionist will be back with a new episode in a couple of weeks about a word that has had a whole lot of different meanings just within living memory, and it has never had an easy or comfortable time. It is so interesting. Find our Illusionist show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and hear all the episodes, read more about the topics, see transcripts, peruse the full dictionary entries of the randomly selected words at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.